It's 106. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Craig Cohen in for Celeste Quinn. This hour, another edition of The Law and You, and this month's topic is misconduct. What happens when a misconduct charge is lodged against a lawyer or a judge? What situations constitute censure or disbarment? And what about the majority of cases that never get to that point? What process does the legal profession use to investigate and possibly reprimand its own? To help us along in our discussion this hour, we have two guests. They are Herb Hoffman and Mary Robinson. Herb Hoffman has practiced law for 32 years. He's a graduate of Washington University and received his law degree from the Washington University Law School. He's also a member of the Missouri Bar Association's Disciplinary Committee for the 21st Judicial District. The committee investigates charges of misconduct by lawyers and judges in the St. Louis area. Mary Robinson is a graduate of the University of Illinois. She received her law degree from the University of Southern California. She is the CEO of the Attorney Registration and Disciplinary Commission of the Illinois Supreme Court, and that commission investigates and on occasion prosecutes charges of lawyer misconduct here in the state of Illinois. As we discuss the misconduct investigative process, we welcome your questions. Our phone numbers, 333-9455 and 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. Perhaps you've had experiences with a lawyer or judge that you found in some way questionable, or you have some concerns about how members of the bar are held accountable for their actions. You can give us a call. Herb Hoffman and Mary Robinson, welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Thank you, Craig.
Glad to have you with us.
Thank you. I might point out one thing. As part of the Missouri Judicial Circuit, we do not discipline judges, only lawyers.
Okay.
And that would be true in Illinois also.
Okay. I'd like to start off, Herb, with you, if I could, if you could just take a few minutes to tell us a little bit about this committee that you're on and what it does.
Basically, we investigate complaints made against various lawyers, usually by laymen, although sometimes by fellow lawyers, as to their misconduct through acts, misdeeds, or omissions. We make a finding, and oftentimes we will recommend the discipline to either directly the Supreme Court or perhaps an interim committee that will, in fact, hold a hearing on behalf of the Supreme Court, and they will actually make the findings.
Now, how often does this this committee meet?
Right now, we're meeting twice a month.
And who makes up the committee?
There are lawyers and two lay people. Four lawyers, two lay people, five lawyers, two lay people, and a lawyer who acts as chairman and administrator and does not vote in the process.
Why the non-lawyers in the group?
We want to get a layman's point of view, an input as to the conduct and the recommended discipline, if any.
And what are there checks in place to be sure that the committee carries out its duties? In other words, you know, there's at least from a layperson's point of view, there might be the concern that, hey, you got a room full of lawyers. What keeps them from just, you know, sweeping any charges under the rug?
As a matter of fact, the lawyers are tougher on the lawyers than the lay people are. It has been my experience over the years since I've been sitting on that committee that oftentimes lay people will recommend not proceeding, not taking any action. Whereas a lawyer, on the other hand, will say, wait a minute, that was wrong. I don't care whether any harm was done or not. The conduct was still wrong, and we have to do something about it. So if that is a concern, I have found that almost uniformly the lawyers are pretty tough people. They have to go in front of.
I suspect that lawyers would want any unethical members of the bar exposed and dealt with as quickly as possible.
Absolutely.
How do individual members go about investigating charges? What is the process? What happens when a charge is filed?
When a charge is filed, the committee will assign the various charges to one particular lawyer to investigate and report on, or one member both layman and lawyer, to investigate thoroughly and to report back to the committee his findings or her findings, and they will make a recommendation that the charge either be dismissed, that the lawyer be reprimanded, or that an information be filed, an information being a legal term that would set forth the actual charges against the lawyer and whereby the committee would, in effect, remove itself from the proceeding and be expecting far greater discipline to be administered to the lawyer in that particular case than they would ordinarily administer.
As that initial investigation is taking place by the individual member of the committee, are there any rules under which that person is required to go about that investigation?
Just the rules of common sense and decency.
Okay.
Basically, we're gonna call both parties. We're gonna say what happened, and we're gonna find out the real nexus, the real problem involved, and ask their opinion, ask them to opine on what they've done or not done, or what the other party has done. And then we'll make the decision when we present the case to the committee as a whole.
Now, one of the conclusions you mentioned that the committee could come to is a reprimand. What types of reprimands take place?
Just that. A written reprimand. It would be published in the Missouri Bar Journal. It is a public document, and it is available to the public. That is the, for the most part, the most serious step that my committee would take. If they think that the conduct was more serious than would be just or rectified by a reprimand, they're going to refer to the Supreme Court, and they will look at it very seriously.
Do you bring in the individual in question?
Yes.
To talk with them? And
yes.
What is that process like?
It's a very informal process. It is a conference held at a lawyer's office in a conference room. In our particular case, it's held at John Doyen's office here in Clayton. In fact, we just met yesterday afternoon. In this particular case, the lawyer could not attend, but the laypeople attended and presented their case to the committee. And the committee will then have the lawyer present at a later date and make their recommendations on the totality of the evidence.
And then the committee cannot meet unless at least one of the non-lawyers is there, is that correct?
It cannot come to a decision.
Oh, cannot come to a decision.
Yeah.
Very well. Okay. Mary, I'd like to bring you into the discussion at this point. First of all, I should point out, of course, that that Herb, you're in a committee that's out of the Missouri Bar Association, and Mary, you're a CEO of an agency out of the Illinois Supreme Court. But I was curious if you could tell us a little bit if Illinois has a similar system in place, either along the lines of the Bar Association or as far as how misconduct is investigated.
Right. Illinois Attorney Registration and Disciplinary Commission is an agency of the Illinois Supreme Court. It is supported entirely by the annual fees that are paid by Illinois lawyers, no tax dollars. In Illinois, states have different procedures. Some states have what they call mandatory bar associations where every lawyer has to be a member. In Illinois, we have a voluntary bar association. And the voluntary state bar association does not handle attorney discipline. It's handled exclusively under the authority of the Supreme Court, and our agency is responsible for investigating the cases. We have a commission that's appointed by the Supreme Court. It's made up of 4 lawyers and 3 non-lawyers, and they act as our board of directors. They set policy, and they also appoint hearing board and inquiry board members who look at the evidence that we've gathered to determine, this would be the inquiry board, would look at evidence that our staff has gathered as to whether or not there's been misconduct. And if they believe we have sufficient evidence, the inquiry panels would approve our filing of a formal complaint of misconduct. And the panels, much like the Missouri system, are made up of two lawyers and one non-lawyer. Non-lawyers have played an important part in the Illinois discipline system for several years. Then if the inquiry panel finds probable cause, we call it, and we file a charge, then the case would be heard by a panel of the hearing board, again made up of two lawyers and one non-lawyer. But our proceedings are a little more formal than what Herb was describing. We have what really looks very much like a trial that is governed by the typical rules of evidence. And then the board will make findings of fact if there's a contest as to what occurred and recommend discipline. Like Missouri, though, our hearing board can impose a reprimand, as can the next stage, which is a review board appointed by the Supreme Court, acts like an appellate tribunal if either side wishes to appeal. But any other discipline has to be imposed by the Illinois Supreme Court, and the court can censure, suspend, or disbar a lawyer who's found guilty of misconduct.
Now, how do the wheels start in motion? If someone has what they see as a problem with a lawyer, what's the first step for them?
Many times the first step is someone will call our office. We have 800 numbers in both the Chicago and Springfield areas. And we will send a person a brochure describing how to make a complaint and what our procedures are. Or sometimes someone writes to us right away. We do ask people to put their complaints in writing because it gives us a beginning basis for looking into the matter. And our staff will help someone who asks for assistance in putting their complaint in writing. Once the complaint is presented to us, we have a staff of intake lawyers who do an initial screening. Oftentimes, if it's not entirely clear what the concerns are, they'll put in a call to the person complaining and try to make sure we understand what their real concerns are. And then every lawyer in Illinois is required to respond to any charge of misconduct. And if there is anything stated by the person complaining that appears to violate the rules, our staff will send the complaint to the lawyer and ask for a response. And typically we ask that the response be sent to us within 14 days. And then we will take the lawyer's response and usually send it back to the person who complained and ask them if they think it answers and if they have anything else that they want us to look into. And a lot depends on where things are at that stage. If there's some serious disagreements about what occurred, we might talk to other witnesses. We often find ourselves looking for court files or other files to verify what either party is saying, and we require our staff to try and resolve those issues. That's the beginning.
How long does this entire process take?
Well, it depends entirely on what the nature of the complaint was. In a complaint that is somewhat typical, where both sides get us the information quickly and where our staff concludes that there is not a basis for bringing a discipline case, it is typically concluded in less than 4 months. In a case where there's an allegation of serious misconduct, it may be a year before the matter is actually brought to a formal stage. And a lot of that depends on the type of evidence we have to get and how hard it is to gather records and enforce subpoenas.
Now, Mary, you mentioned that your system, compared to what Herb was describing, is certainly more formal. Is there a situation where a case can be dealt with very informally, as in maybe a member of the commission can pull aside the individual in question and find some way for them to make good on whatever the issue is and just resolve it, as opposed to going through the process, or is that something that's sort of frowned upon?
No, that happens a lot, actually, and it's not atypical in the very early stages. If our lawyer sees a problem that can be resolved, it's not atypical that he or she will pick up the phone and try and get in touch with the lawyer and the client and see if there isn't some way to resolve it. A typical situation is an instance where a client hired a lawyer, isn't pleased with the progress that the lawyer is making, and wants a refund of their fee. It's not atypical that our lawyer will ask the lawyer if he or she is willing to make a refund, and if the refund's made, we close the file. So that happens very often.
Herb, do you find that's the case also in Missouri?
Yes, and in those certain instances where money is the issue, the lawyer has been paid a fee or a retainer by the client. The client is complaining that either nothing was done or that what was done was totally inadequate. The initial recommendation to the lawyer is, look, refund the money, make the client happy, and the client can go on his or her way. You can go on your way. But always with an admonition that let's not get engaged in this type of conduct again, period. We don't want it. If you're going to take somebody's money, do the work.
It seems like you could easily get inundated with complaints in either state, just based on the fact that even dealing with just trial lawyers, you know, somebody's going to win in the trial and somebody's going to lose, and whoever loses might be tempted to say, oh, well, there was something wrong with my lawyer, and then bring it to you guys. Do you find that's the case ever?
Sometimes, yes. And that's why we look at it. And oftentimes we look at the case itself and the witnesses that were called. And the lawyers who investigate these complaints go about it in a very thorough manner. They typically do not take anybody's word for it. They want independent verification, and they'll get it, whether it's from lay witnesses or lawyer witnesses or judges. They'll do it, though. And they'll get the answers.
Mary, do you find that's the case in Illinois as
Absolutely.
Well?
You know, we any complaint that comes to us in writing, we tally. And typically we see between 6,000 and 7,000 a year. Out of those, there is a substantial percentage that appear to be motivated by the fact that either the client or the opposing party was unhappy with what happened in litigation. And they really don't involve a concern as far as the lawyer's conduct, except that the lawyer was perhaps the messenger, you know, or the bearer of bad news, or involved. So we see a fair amount of that. We also see a fair number of cases where lawyers might be attending to business, but they're doing an inadequate job conferring with the client, so the client really doesn't know what's happening in the case. So a lot of those things happen, and I agree with Herb. There is a sense that when that comes through our door in the first instance, we try to make sure that lawyers realize that they could avoid these problems and that they owe it to their clients to avoid them. If they could just be more cautious in how they set up communications with the clients. You know, and that accounts for, those kinds of things account for a great deal of the volume of our cases. Then there's the other side of the spectrum, and those are the, you know, a handful of cases involving but very serious misconduct, and we try to reserve, you know, a particular response to that, and that response is get it to a formal stage quickly, and there are a handful of lawyers who really do pose a danger of some future misconduct toward other clients, and when we see that happening, we try and get in there and interfere with their license as quickly as possible.
That's Mary Robinson. She's an attorney at law and CEO of the Illinois Attorney Registration and Disciplinary Commission. Our other guest is Herb Hoffman, also an attorney and member of Missouri Bar Association Disciplinary Committee for the 21st Judicial District. We're talking about lawyer misconduct, and we welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. We're talking about what happens when misconduct charges are lodged against a lawyer, and perhaps you have some examples of that very situation, or perhaps you've had a situation where you feel that a lawyer has done an inadequate job, or you're just curious about the system. Give us a call. Again, 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. Now, when there is a case of, you know, either a significant serious charge of misconduct, what are the majority of cases that you deal with? Are most complaints related to finances, a lawyer overcharging a client for billable hours or something like that?
Well, I'll give you a perfect example, because I had it come up, we had it come up yesterday, and frankly, the allegation was outright theft. And when that happens, and as in the case in Illinois, we treat those allegations very, very seriously. We try and get the questions resolved immediately or as soon as possible. And frankly, our committee, and I'm sure ours is just typical, we take very serious action if, in fact, money has been misappropriated.
Herb, without mentioning any names, obviously, as this is an ongoing case, can you give any indication or details of what specifically is the charge that someone is lodging against the particular lawyer?
Plain out theft.
And just can you give any of the circumstances?
But the lawyer is accused of not accounting to the client, of helping himself to substantial funds from a trust and or a series of trusts, and we are going to look at that very, very seriously.
What was it that the lawyer was supposed to be doing for the client?
Well, he was supposed to administer the trust, and in the process of administering the trust, gather in the funds belonging to the ultimately the client, and then disperse them to the client. And the allegation is, in the interim, he withheld a substantial amount of money.
Mary, do you find in Illinois that it usually the more serious charges deal with financial considerations, something dealing with they simply didn't do the job they were expected to do?
Well, most of the really serious cases do involve the improper handling of funds. There are many instances where lawyers hold money for other people. For instance, in a real estate transaction, a lawyer might hold the earnest money, or when there's been a settlement of a case, typically the settlement check is written to the lawyer and the client, and the lawyer deposits the proceeds in the lawyer's trust account and then disperses to anyone who has an interest that has to be paid. And in a handful of cases every year, there are instances where the lawyers either intentionally or negligently start using that money that really belongs to someone else. It is typical, a lawyer will usually be disbarred if there's any finding of an intentional use of the money, and they'll be suspended even if the use was unintentional, because they are supposed to be holding it for someone else. And even if the other person doesn't lose a wink, you know what I mean, doesn't really realize that the money's been used, it's a serious breach of ethics for a lawyer to do that. But we had, I think, you know, our statistics suggest that we had maybe 50 cases last year where lawyers were disciplined, either disbarred or suspended for the mishandling of funds.
Let's take a call. We have a caller on line 4 from Eureka. Hi, welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Hi, may I ask 2 questions, please?
Certainly.
You were sort of getting at my my question when you used one of the guests used the figure 50 were, I believe, disbarred for mishandling of funds. The general question would be, in a given year, what does it appear to be the number? I realize it would go up or down of the total number of lawyers who are disbarred or disciplined by the ARDC.
In a given year, about 100 to 135 lawyers are disciplined. And I would say usually at least 30% are disbarred Do you know what I mean?
Of that 135, 30%
right.
of that, I see.
Right. And then another substantial portion. Most of the lawyers who are disciplined are either disbarred or suspended.
Are the suspensions usually of the same duration, or they vary with the offense?
They vary greatly with the nature of the conduct. There can be a suspension of only a few months, but there are also suspensions of 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years, and there are some very onerous suspensions that look more like a disbarment, because however long the suspension is for, in order to practice again, the lawyer has to be reinstated, and it's a very major undertaking to get reinstated in Illinois.
Would you have the figures about the total number of judges each year that may be booted out of office, and what the name escaped? There is a judicial commission that does that, isn't there, in Illinois?
That's right. There's the Judicial Inquiry Board is the agency that investigates and brings charges, and then there is the Illinois Courts Commission, which hears the charges and determines what the sanction would be.
Does that figure vary quite a bit from year to year about the total number of judges that action is taken against?
I don't have their statistics, but yes, I'm sure it varies, and I know it's significantly less than lawyers.
My second question is there a working definition that you use or are aware of legal malpractice?
Malpractice is not what we charge when a lawyer gets in trouble here.
Mm-hmm.
Malpractice really is what a client sues a lawyer for and can get damages. We look at a couple things that most people might use the term malpractice, and one is that the lawyer fails to provide competent services. And the other, which is much more a concern that we're dealing with, is that the lawyer fails to act diligently. And that really is the area where we are most frequently asked to look at what a lawyer has done. And that accounts for at least a third of our caseload in terms of the formal cases that we bring.
There, I believe there's in the law, I've seen on some of the small claims courts, a professional has a duty of due diligence. Is that the kind of standard you're applying for a lawyer?
Right. And the lawyer, it's both in terms of making sure that the right things are done at the right time. Let me put it this way. A lawyer clearly has failed in their duty of diligence to a client if the lawyer allows a case to be dismissed, lets the client's case be dismissed. But a lawyer also fails in that duty short of the case being dismissed. There was a case a couple of years ago where the Supreme Court disciplined a lawyer for not concluding divorces in a timely way, even though eventually the divorces were concluded in the way the clients wanted them concluded. And the court said that a client has a right to expect that this be done with some pace, you know, and with the client being kept informed along the way. So there's a real spectrum of what a lawyer can fail to do that might cause them to face disciplinary consequences.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the phone call. And how can a lawyer know if what they're doing is right or wrong?
Well,
I'm just, you know.
I don't know that he or she can absolutely know. But I will think that over a period of time in practicing law, you know if you're not handling a case expeditiously. If a client comes into my office, for instance, and wants a lawsuit filed, I can't even think of a reason why it would take me some months to get it filed. I can think of reasons why it might not proceed as quickly as the client would like or hope. But getting it filed, I don't have a good explanation or a good reason for that.
Right, and I agree with her. The practice of law is an art, not a science. And so there is room in any instance, for a disagreement about how quickly somebody could or should act. But a lot has to do. There are clearly legal limits where something has to be filed, and when a lawyer crosses those, they know that they have disciplinary consequences or could face disciplinary consequences short of that, it's really a question of the fact that lawyers really owe this duty of loyalty and diligence to their clients, and a lot has to do with the lawyer being careful in defining what reasonable expectations are and then meeting them.
Are there specific programs or documents that either the Bar Association or the ARDC put out or present to lawyers to sort of help them as a guide, particularly, you know, somebody who's maybe just passed the bar?
Continuously.
Right.
We have, and I'm sure it's the same in Illinois, what we call continuing legal education. And every year, interspersed in all the substantive legal programs are those programs aimed at conduct, at teaching lawyers how to keep track of all their files, how to keep in contact with all their clients, how to keep the client up to date on what is going on. And hopefully, in the process of doing that, avoid complaints. And avoid ill feelings, unfortunately.
Right.
They don't always work.
One of the things we've found in Illinois is, and I think this is true, I've heard many people from other jurisdictions say the same thing. Over the last, say, decade or maybe much closer, maybe two decades, there have been some trends in the practice of law. And one is that there are more lawyers, and there are more lawyers fighting for business. And especially during hard times, the lawyers really have to stretch to be able to get enough business to keep themselves floating. And it does seem that over time, maybe, we've lost some of what used to be the practice of mentoring newer lawyers. Initially, at the ARDC, we were concerned that it was new lawyers pretty much fresh out of school who were not getting the kind of guidance that they probably needed in order to practice. And I'm talking mostly about the ones who went out on their own. But recently, I have heard representatives of some of the malpractice carriers mention that they are seeing more claims against newer lawyers who have jobs with firms.
Hmm.
And their sense is that the firms are so busy trying to keep things going. Time bringing the younger lawyers along aren't doing that. So throughout the country, I think we've seen the bar associations trying to put together programs, especially for the lawyers who are recently out of law school. The Illinois State Bar and the Chicago Bar Association each put on programs every time there's lawyers are admitted twice in Illinois every year. And for each of those classes, the bar associations put on programs called Bridging the Gap that are meant to help the younger lawyers understand some of those practices. And it's exactly what Herb said. Much of it is what we call law office management rather than, you know, the substantive issues of law. It's actually the practice skills and how do you structure, a system for communicating with clients and keeping files and keeping records as far as your trust accounts, and how do you bill, you know, get out bills timely. A lot of lawyers make the mistake of not billing on a timely basis, and clients are wondering what's going to happen to them, and they're not, you know, when they're surprised, they're never happy. So anyway, there are a lot of efforts underway to do that. And then finally, another thing we've been doing recently is we have a very intensive program that involves trying to train lawyers on some of those issues for the lawyers who have gotten in trouble. So typically, if a lawyer is disciplined these days in Illinois for having neglected their client's cases or any related matter, or mishandled funds, they find themselves directed to go to this school. And it's three Saturdays taught by at least a dozen different practicing lawyers, depending on the topic, and meant to try and help them develop those kinds of practices so that they will not find themselves in trouble again.
We're talking about lawyer misconduct with Herb Hoffman, member of Missouri Bar Association Disciplinary Committee for the 21st Judicial District, and Mary Robinson, CEO of the Illinois Attorney Registration and Disciplinary Commission. And we welcome your questions and comments. We have about 10 minutes left. Our phone number is 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. How can someone recover money or property that's lost due to a lawyer's misconduct?
Well, in Missouri, and typically it will involve an allegation of theft by a lawyer. And oftentimes, whatever committee is going to handle that particular complaint, the committee or a member will say, number one, first and foremost, repay the money. And number two, then we're going to talk about how we can restructure your overall conduct so that this doesn't happen again. But the first thing that the lawyer has to do is repay the money.
And Mary, in Illinois, there's something called the Client Protection Program. Could you explain what that is?
That's correct. The Client Protection Program is it's a fund that is financed, again, by the attorney's annual fees. Any client who has been defrauded by a lawyer, has lost money because of a lawyer's dishonesty, can make a claim to the fund. There are limits on the amount of any one claim that can be paid. But the Attorney Registration and Disciplinary Commission, the commissioners review the claims, and if they find that they're legitimate, then they pay out to the defrauded client a sum, up to the cap of $10,000 per claim. But it's also true in Illinois that a lawyer who has taken money would be required to pay restitution, and they will not practice again until they have paid the restitution.
And whether that program covers the particular case, I guess, determined on a case-by-case basis.
That's correct. And typically they are cases in which a lawyer was holding money from someone and misused it. That is covered. And it is also another area where we see claims are ones where a lawyer takes a fee and in hindsight it appears that the lawyer really never intended to do work. We have a handful of cases every year where lawyers essentially abandon their practices. They seem to fall off the face of the earth. And those kinds of cases also generate a fair number of claims.
Either one of you ever come across a case where a lawyer is charged with flat-out throwing a case for a
no.
client?
No.
Never?
No. For the most part, lawyers are combative by nature. I don't think I've ever seen one instance. Well, I have. I take it back. I have seen one instance, and in fact, that particular lawyer has been disciplined. But lawyers in general are bulldogs, and once they get a hold of a case for a client, they're going to fight tooth and nail. And I think that's almost universally true of lawyers. We're not in business to sell out a client.
It seems like the most difficult part of being a part of a commission or a committee in these situations is that probably it comes down to one person's opinion versus another, it's some sort of interpersonal dispute. How do you resolve that? What do you do when it basically comes down to the client says one thing, the lawyer says the other?
You look at what I call and call in general in practice certain type keys. Would a lawyer do this thing if they were not diligently representing their client? And sometimes just answering that simple question with a yes or a no gives you the answer you're looking for. You may not I may not, or anybody may not, agree with a lawyer's tact. That is, the way he is going about, or she is going about, representing a client. But I think the cases are rare and very few and far between where you ever can accuse a lawyer of not representing a client, not doing what they were hired to do. And that doesn't happen. It does not come up. And I think that's a credit to the way we're trained. We're trained from day one in law school to fight fairly and fight honestly, but by all means, you're in a fight and you best realize it and you better do your best to win.
Do either of you ever have any concerns that, that fellow lawyers might see you as, you know, the sort of internal affairs department of your occupation? Do you ever have any sort of political pressure or pressure from other lawyers to say, oh, you know, don't be so hard on this guy or that guy or this lawyer or that lawyer?
No. As a matter of fact, most lawyers almost universally look at us and they say, oh, my God, you're sitting on that committee. Thank God it's you and not me. I'd hate to have to do what you do. But, you know, when you accept admission to the Bar Association, you do assume certain responsibilities. And they are not all pleasant.
I think that lawyers have mixed feelings. I mean, when they're the ones who are in the hot seat, they tend to see us as internal affairs, and that's not uncommon. But for the most part, lawyers really do take their ethical obligations very seriously, and they may not love us, but I think most lawyers feel that it's a function that's very important. And I think you could compare lawyers with any other profession, and it would probably be true that there are many more lawyers who are disciplined every year for things that I think Herb mentioned earlier that a non-lawyer may not take as seriously. Lawyers take certain things very seriously and really enforce those obligations in a fairly rigorous way. And I think that we all know whether it's not a pleasant endeavor, but we all know that it's important to all the ethical lawyers being able to continue to serve clients that we actually go about this and we really do it with some intensity.
We're almost out of time. Mary, you mentioned that there were a couple of 800 numbers for your offices.
Right.
Could you give those out for those who might have some sort of complaint or concern?
Right. The 800 number that reaches our Chicago office is 1-800-826-8625. And the number that reaches our Springfield office is 1-800-252-8048. Anyone can call either office. Typically, cases that involve lawyers whose practice occurs south of I-80, we tend to send to our Springfield office, and north of I-80, we tend to send to our Chicago office. But anyone can feel free to call either place.
And likewise, in Missouri, all contacts should be directed to the Office of the Chief Disciplinary Counsel. In Jefferson City, their address is 3535 American Avenue. The zip code is 65109. Or they can contact the Missouri Bar Association directly in Jefferson City. Their phone number is area code 573-635-4128. And they also have an email. It is the Missouri Bar and MoBar, .org.
Okay. Well, I want to say thank you to both of you. Unfortunately, we are completely out of time. My thanks to Herb Hoffman from the Missouri Bar Association's 21st Judicial District Disciplinary Committee and Mary Robinson, CEO of the Illinois Attorney Registration and Disciplinary Commission. Thank you both very much for joining us today on the Afternoon Magazine.